Here's part three of the horror talk of the O.J. Simpson murder case. Now the Bronco Chase, literally that's from KTVU Fox 2 San Francisco YouTube channel.
The intersection of the 5 and the 91 freeway. One thing we have been noticing, again, it's a very slow pursuit, followed by numerous highway patrol vehicles. But because of the intensity, it seems like people have heard about what's going on. And all the overpasses that we've seen have been lined with cars. What has been going on down below as the presumed vehicle of O.J. Simpson is still traveling very slowly northbound along the 5 freeway, coming up again towards the 91 intersection. At that point, we'll just have to wait and see which way he's going to go. But at this point, it's still a fairly laid-back situation, a dangerous situation at the same time, because, again, the Highway Patrol does not want to intimidate, and I repeat, do not want to intimidate this vehicle into doing anything that they really don't want him to do. And the main thing is to get him pulled over as safely as possible. And there's only a couple ways that'll happen. One is him just pulling over and or running out of gas. So at this point, we can only pray that they'll be able to pull this off in a safe measure. Absolutely. Again, Pat, at this point, it is a pursuit. And unfortunately, it has a lot of mitigating circumstances because of the high profile of the proposed suspect that's inside the vehicle, which could possibly be and appears to be at this time O.J. Simpson. Absolutely, and you know, I don't know if I should say this or not, but we have seen one vehicle in the past that actually ended the pursuit at Parker Center. So it'd be quite ironic if that was to happen with this one traveling all of the 5, get to Los Angeles, and then just go right and give up at Parker Center. So we'll just have to see what happens. Nine copies. Don't worry, I will.
What about with him surrendering? I'm not sure if that's like probably, but who knows? Surrender? Probably not sure. OJ Chase ending. Okay.
Again, if we can continue to speculate.
Like, this is like the final few minutes of the notorious slow speed chase of that white Bronco with O.J. Simpson inside.
It will be interesting to see if he is allowed to go into the mansion itself or whether he will be stopped short of it.
That's a good question.
Remember, there are people there in that mansion, and I don't think law enforcement wants any kind of siege to take place. Then again, it is possible he may have said on the phone, all I want to do is see my mother and children, and then I will surrender. So that is also a point for speculation, too.
It's hard to say what in the world is on his mind at this point.
That's right.
Mark Lutner apparently has information that that is exactly where he's going, or at least that's the feeling at the LA police headquarters. Mark, what are you hearing?
Well, we understand that he turned off the 405 freeway onto Sunset. That's a route that we've been taking for days now because it leads, if he went west on Sunset, toward his own house. It also leads to the murder scene, which was the home of Nicole Brown Simpson.
Mark,
that
appears,
may be where he's going.
Mark, it appears now he's turning into his own home.
There are people staked out on the corner. Now they're running after the car. It appears that they're reporters. There are already police cars in place there. As near as we can tell, there are the satellite trucks. So obviously, he's going home. There's no no two ways about it.
Running right past the news crews that have been there throughout the week.
He's
and
making
now,
a turn right
there
into
is that
the driveway.
Familiar driveway we have seen all week long, and
he's
we
home.
Don't know if his mother is possibly here at his home.
That might be another option. Have you heard anything more about where his mother is? They're coming out to the car right now.
Oh, wait a minute.
Ooh. Is he telling him to get away?
Let me tell you what I can see. We've just turned the corner.
There's a police officer.
Pulling someone away who was inside the property.
Total chaos here.
Get down.
Motorcycles, black and white, people running around. Officers getting out of their cars with their... with their batons, people running, people keeping, they're keeping our cameras away.
We got to remind you really quickly, this is a live picture. We have no idea what is going to happen here, and apparently there is a weapon, there is a gun, so bear with us, this is live television.
They're not letting us get up close enough to actually see what's going on with the naked eye, so you have the best viewpoint from the outside.
Behind that Bronco, there's apparently a marked police unit with its lights on. Officers appear to be
having
their guns drawn, and they are standing behind their police cars. They're pulled up behind the Bronco.
If this shot would widen out, you might be able to see it's underneath that tree right there in the upper left-hand part of your screen.
And we have so far not seen anyone get out of that Ford Bronco.
Some officers have their guns drawn. The one officer who was standing on the porch did not appear to have a weapon out. Somebody came up to that driver's seat. Presumably that was Al Cowlings, OJ's friend, the man whose car that is, and he pushed him away.
Exactly. We understand that Al Cowling is still inside this car also along with.
Nobody's gotten out of the car. The flashers are still on, and it appears to be parked. Tinted window, so it's very difficult to tell what's going on inside there.
We understand now that was O.J. Simpson's son who came out to the Bronco and was pushed away. And we're getting these reports in and passing them along to you immediately. This is a live picture. O.J. Simpson inside that Ford Bronco with his friend, and he has been on more than an hour-long drive to his own Brentwood mansion, and he had been demanding to see his mother, and he is holding a gun on himself.
Three of the networks are now reporting that somebody has already been hauled out of that Ford Bronco by police. Of course, the speculation, there are only two people in that car. They believe it was either O.J. Simpson himself or this Al Cowlings gentleman, the friend. I just saw them pull in. There was somebody in the driver's side now, and I don't think we ever lost our bird's eye view. But again, we want to let you know what other news organizations are saying. But that would explain why he was so adamant to get him away. He just didn't want anything to happen. If that's OJ's son, those kids have been through so much already.
Right. They now have such a touchy situation on their hands. This is at O.J. Simpson's Brentwood Mansion. He is in that Ford Bronco, the white car you see in the center of your screen. You see the long line of police cars parked out on the street. They are trying to contact him or have him in contact by cellular phone.
That cell phone apparently also leading them. They're pleading with him to come out. You see, the officer seems to be reaching for a weapon. I can't really tell. But supposedly now, and this explains why the path was so clear, LAPD claiming that they knew he was going to the Brentwood estate CHP, California Highway Patrol, was indicating that he was headed to Cerritos. One would think if the children might be there, the mother is there. We just don't know.
A good possibility, and that's what he had been demanding, to see his mother. Again, he wrote three letters, one to his mother, one to his children, and one to a friend, which we have already relayed to you, the letter in its entirety. And again, this situation gets more and more tense as the minutes pass. There is a police car pulled in very close behind that Ford Bronco. There are officers all around the property right now. Some of them have their weapons drawn, and we are waiting to see what's going to happen.
LAPD seems to be, at this point, the only police officers I can see around the vicinity. We had indications earlier that there was a SWAT team on alert, those types of things. Whether those people are now into play outside here, we really don't know. Again, they are saying somebody has been pulled out of the car, but Rob, I'm like you, I never did see that happen. It pulled in, the boy rushed over, he was pushed away
by somebody,
basically, and it was from the driver's seat.
And then pulled back by a couple of officers.
As soon as he got far back, who did not have weapons drawn at that particular moment. That also O.J. Simpson supposedly is in the back seat with the gun. At one point, somebody could see a shot of him slumped over in the back seat. So we don't know. We don't know what's going on back there.
We had reports in that his voice was slurred, his speech was slurred as he was using the cellular phone to talk to authorities. Again, as Kelly has mentioned, his attorney says he's been taking medication for severe depression throughout the week since this investigation began today, charged with two murders and then disappeared. And now this is where they have found O.J. Simpson. He has taken them on an hour or two, an hour and a half long ride through Los Angeles to his own Brentwood home. And right now he is inside that car and he may have a gun.
Let's listen to what the L.A. stations are saying while we have that opportunity.
If he could see his mother and the children and make some statement perhaps or talk to them, that maybe then there would be a surrender to the police. Did you gain altitude? Are you up at a...
Yes, Hal, we sure did. We're about 2,100 feet above the scene. Okay. That's mean sea level, which puts us up about 1,500 feet above the ground.
You still have an excellent picture, and we can see everything going on at that point, Craig.
Yes, this excellent vantage point from this location, as you can see. As details develop here, we should be able to see quite clearly what will take place.
The helicopter there.
O.J. Simpson wrote a letter to his children and to his mother and then to his friends. And his attorney.
Yeah, said, that letter was read this afternoon.
Hmm. So, yeah, So at the preliminary hearing on June 20, Simpson was arraigned, pleaded not guilty to both murders, and was held without bail. The following day, a grand jury indicted him for the two murders. Still, it was dismissed on June 23 due to excessive media coverage that could have influenced its neutrality. Instead, authorities held a probable cause hearing to determine whether to bring Simpson to trial. California Superior Court Judge Kathleen Kennedy Powell ruled on July 7 that there was sufficient evidence to bring Simpson to trial for the murders. At his second arraignment on July 22, when asked how he pleaded to the murders, Simpson firmly stated, quote, absolutely 100% not guilty, end quote. Guys, I'm so sorry, but I'll take a short break. 1 second. Here's the continuation of part 3 of the horror talk of the O.J. Simpson murder case. So, Jill Shively testified to the grand jury that soon after the murders, she saw a white Ford Bronco speeding away from Bundy Drive in such a hurry that it almost collided with a Nissan at the intersection of Bundy and San Vicente Boulevard, and that she recognized Simpson's voice. She talked to the television show Hard Copy for $5,000, after which prosecutors declined to use her testimony at trial. Jose Camacho of Rose Country provided store receipts showing Simpson had purchased a 12-inch stiletto knife 6 weeks before the murders. The knife was recovered and determined to be similar to what the coroner said caused the stab wounds. The prosecution did not present this evidence at trial after Camacho sold his story to the National Enquirer for $12,500. Tests on the knife determined that the oil used on the new cutlery was still present on the knife, indicating it had never been used. Former NFL player and pastor Rosie Grier visited Simpson on November 13 at the Los Angeles County Jail. In the days following the murders, a jailhouse guard, Jeff Storr, testified to Judge Ito that at one point, Simpson yelled to Grier that he, quote, didn't mean to do it, end quote, after which Grier had urged Simpson to come clean. It ruled that that the evidence was inadmissible as being protected because of clergy penitent privilege. Here's a video of the video vault, July 1994, the people watching the O.J. Simpson pre-Limerini hearing.
It's almost impossible to find someone who hasn't watched the O.J. Simpson coverage. At the Willow Lawn Food Court, lunchtime customers look for the waiters.
Has there been too much O.J. Simpson?
I think so, yeah. But the people want it, so I guess they give them what they want.
Don't tell that to News Channel 6 receptionist Pat Burns.
But we are transmitting what CBS is sending us into New York.
She's taken more than 500 calls from viewers upset the Simpson trials preempting the afternoon soaps. Denise Trice works downtown for Scott and Stringfellow. She knows plenty of people who want the soap back on the air.
You can't really see any normal programming or anything like that. And I know people around here expect their soaps and things like that. And you've got this. And it's kind of boring and monotonous after a while.
Several others joining Denise in the company lunchroom agree there's been too much of OJ.
I think take a lot of programs off the air just to do this O.J. Simpson hearing. Hopefully it'll be a fair trial, you know.
And you'd like to see some of your regular programs come back on?
Yeah, exactly.
So did you know how to set the alarm on the house?
No.
But CBS Network defends the live coverage. Their ratings show people are interested. In fact, O.J.'s hearing is outperforming the soap operas. This man who has OJ's rookie football card is one of those viewers.
I'm just kind of, I don't want to say interested, but just kind of on the edge of my seat trying to figure out what's going to happen next.
Whether or not you're fed up with the OJ Simpson saga, chances are there will be plenty more. After all, this is just the preliminary hearing. Once the trial begins, it's likely all four major networks will once again continue their live coverage. Stay tuned. In Richmond, Roger Harvey, WTVR, News Channel 6.
At first, Simpson's defense sought to show that one or more hitmen hired by drug dealers had murdered Brown and Goldman, giving Brown a Colombian necktie because they were looking for Brown's friend, Faye Resnick, a known cocaine user who had failed to pay for her drugs. Oh. She stayed at Brown's condo for several days until entering rehab 4 days before the killings. It ruled that the drug killer theory was highly speculative with no evidence to support it. Consequently, Ito barred the jury from hearing it and prohibited Christian Rye Charge from testifying about his former girlfriend Resnick's drug problems. Rosa Lopez, a neighbor Spanish speaking housekeeper, stated on August 18 that she saw Simpson's Bronco parked outside his house at the time of the murders, supporting his claim he was home that night. During cross-examination by Clark, Lopez admitted she was unsure when she saw Simpson's Bronco, but the defense still intended to call her. However, Lopez's taped July 29 statement did not mention seeing the Bronco, but did mention another housekeeper was also there that night, Sylvia Goera. Prosecutors then spoke with Goera, who said Lopez was lying and claimed the defense offered both housekeepers $5,000 to say they saw the Bronco that night. When Ito warned the defense that Goera's claim, as well as the earlier statement not mentioning the Bronco and the tape where Clark claims, quote, that Lopez is being coached on what to say, end quote, will be shown to the jury if Lopez testifies, they dropped her from the witness list. The media coverage, when the trial began, this is what Marsha Clark from 2010 said, when the trial began, all the networks were getting these hate mail letters because people's soap operas were being interrupted for the Simpson trial. But then the people who liked soap operas got addicted to the Simpson trial, and they got agitated when the Simpson trial was over, and people would come up to me on the street and say, God, I loved your show, end quote. The murders and trial, the biggest story I've ever... The murders and trial, quote, the biggest story I have ever seen, end quote, said a prosecutor, said a producer of NBC's Today received extensive media coverage from the very beginning. At least one instant book was proposed 2 hours after the bodies were found and scheduled to publish only a few weeks later. The case was a seminal event in the history of reality television. The Los Angeles Times covered the case on its front page more than 300 days after the murders. The nightly news broadcast from the Big Three television networks gave more airtime to the case than to the Bosnian War and the Oklahoma City bombing combined. The Bosnian War. I heard of that before. I wasn't born there, but my mom told me about this, so yes. The media outlets served an enthusiastic audience. One company put the loss of national productivity from employees following the case instead of working at $40 billion. The Tonight Show with Jay Leno aired many skits on the trial and dancing. A trope of dancers dressed as a judge was a popular recurring segment. According to Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post, the acquittal was, quote, the most dramatic courtroom verdict in the history of Western civilization, end quote. Oh my God. Yes. Participants in the case received much media coverage. Limo driver Park said the media offered him $100,000, but refused, as he will be removed as a witness. Fans approached Clark at restaurants and malls, and when she got a new hairstyle during the trial, the prosecutors received a standing ovation on the courthouse steps. People approved of the change, but advised her to wear more fitted suits and tailored skirts. While Katrin Bailey and Dershowitz were already well known, others like Kaylin became celebrities, and Resnick and Simpson's girlfriend Paula Barbieri appeared in Playboy. Those involved in the trial followed their media coverage. When Larry King appeared in the courtroom after a meeting with Itil, both Simpson and Clark praised King's talk show. Interest in the case was worldwide. Russian President Boris Yeltsin's first question to President Clinton when they met in 1995 was, quote, when they met in 1995 was, quote, do you think OJ did it, end quote. Whether to allow video cameras into the courtroom was among the first issues Judge Ito had to decide, ultimately ruling that live camera coverage was warranted. It was later criticized for this decision by other legal professionals. Dershowitz said that he believed that Ito, along with others related to the case, such as Clark, Furman, and Kaylin, was influenced to some degree by the media presence and related publicity. The trial was covered in 2,237 news segments from 1994 through 1997. Wow, 25 years. It was also criticized for allowing the trial to become a media circus and not doing enough to regulate the court proceedings. Among the reporters who covered the trial daily from the courtroom and the media area that was dubbed Camp OJ were Steve Futterman of CBS News, Linda Dodge and Michael Fleeman of the Associated Press, Dan Whitcomb of Reuters, Janet Gilmore of the Los Angeles Daily News, Andrea Ford of the Los Angeles Times, Michelle Caruso of the New York Daily News, Dan Abrams of Court TV, Harvey Levin of KCBS, and David Margolick of the New York Times. Writers Dominic Dool and Joel McGinnis and Joseph Bosco also had full-time seats in the courtroom, of course. Say, like, Court News, maybe? I'm not sure, honestly. inside the case of the defense during, but that's actually, like, part two, of course. Like, what? So, yeah. No, I'm trying to see like any news, but unfortunately there is. I'm so sorry, guys. Oh wait. Yes. Okay, never mind. From the archives, media circus around OJ Simpson trial.
They have come from across the globe, bringing their satellite trucks, pulling miles of cable, setting up housekeeping and putting down stakes. You might not believe it, but they're here to stay a while.
I found 49 cameramen, 25 anchors, 20 producers I could see, but a lot of them were inside a truck.
With them come the t-shirt hawkers.
OJ today, OJ.
The attention seekers, the curious.
Please don't forget the victims.
I think there is an amazing, ravenous appetite for information about O.J. Simpson. A few of the board take time for a nap, while the chorus line of reporters outside the criminal courts building give live analysis.
Simpson sits at the defense table wearing a dark suit and tie and a grim expression.
Blood stain and fiber evidence is substantial enough for samples to be shared between the prosecution and the defense.
Inside the court building, another zoo. Reporters sit glued to small monitors, watching, waiting for any new evidence in the case that's captured the attention of the world.
That's Nicole's mother and sister.
Right down 1058.
You get that?
Local Los Angeles television stations eclipsed an entire day of programming for the testimony. How much is too much? And is the public served by all this?
If we're doing anything good in the process of revealing all this information, I think maybe we are. You know, I'm an attorney myself, and I think that it's useful. It's educational in the sense that people learn how the system works. It's tragic and unfortunate that this is the way that we have to learn how our judicial system operates, but maybe at least we can take something away from it that's of some benefit to us.
One indication of public interest: on the Friday night when O.J. Simpson fled the police, 95 million Americans watched the live television coverage. Now, with all three networks covering the preliminary hearing live, from Boise to Bismarck, it's the only show in town.
People in North Dakota aren't going to come to L.A. to see what happens to O.J., but that doesn't mean they're not interested. That doesn't mean they don't have a vital interest in it. And we let them sit in their homes or their offices or their wherever and watch.
And while some may see the media as much too much, others can find beauty in just about anything. Sandra Hughes, CBS News, Los Angeles.
On June 27, 1994, Time published a cover story in American Tragedy with a photo of Simpson on the cover. The image was darker than a typical magazine image, and the Time photo was darker than the original as shown on a Newsweek cover release at the same time. Time became the subject of a media scandal. Commentators found that its staff had used photo manipulation to darken the photo and speculated it was to make Simpson appear more menacing. After the photo publication drew widespread criticism for racist editorializing and yellow journalism, Time publicly apologized. Charles Oaktree, a former criminal defense attorney and current professor at Harvard Law School, said in a 2005 interview for PBS Frontline that the best investigative reporting around the events and facts of the murder and the evidence of the trial was by the National Enquirer. So Simpson wanted a speedy trial, and the defense and prosecuting attorneys worked around the clock for several months to prepare their cases. The trial began on January 24, 1995, 7 months after the murders, and was televised by closed circuit TV camera via Court TV and in part by other cable and network news outlets for 134 days. Judge Lance Ito presided over the trial in the C.S. Foltz Criminal Courts building. And the jury, District Attorney Gil Garcetti, elected to file charges in downtown Los Angeles as opposed to Santa Monica, in which jurisdiction the crimes took place. The Los Angeles Superior Court then decided to hold the trial in downtown Los Angeles instead of Santa Monica due to safety issues at the Santa Monica courthouse. The decision may have affected the trial's outcome because it resulted in a less educated jury pool, lower incomes, and contained more African Americans. Richard Gabriel, a jury consultant for Simpson, wrote that more educated jurors with higher incomes were more likely to accept the validity of DNA evidence and the argument that domestic violence is a prelude to a murder. Gabriel noted that African Americans were far more likely than other minorities to be receptive to claims of racially motivated fraud by the police. In October 1994, Judge Lance Ito started interviewing 304 prospective jurors. On November 3, 12 jurors were seated with 12 alternatives. Throughout the trial, 10 were dismissed for a variety of reasons. Only 4 of the original jurors remained on the final panel. According to media reports, Clark believed women, regardless of race, would sympathize with the domestic violence aspect of the case and connect with Brown personally. On the other hand, the defense research suggested that Black women would not be sympathetic to Brown, who was white, because of tensions about interracial marriages. Both sides accepted a disproportionate number of female jurors from an original jury pool of 40% white, 28% Black, 17% Hispanic, and 15% Asian. The final jury for the trial had 10 women and 2 men, of whom 9 were Black, 2 white, and 1 Hispanic. On April 5, 1995, juror Jeanette Harris was dismissed when Judge Ito learned she had failed to disclose an incident of domestic abuse. Afterward, Harris gave an interview, accused the deputies of racism, and claimed the jurors were dividing themselves along racial lines. Ito then met with the jurors, who all denied Harris's allegations of racial tension among themselves. The following day, Ito dismissed the 3 deputies anyway, which upset the jurors, but that did not complain because the dismissal appeared to lend credence to Harris's allegations, which they all denied. On April 21, 13 of the 18 jurors refused to come to court until they spoke with Ito about it. Ito then ordered them to court, and the 13 protesters responded by wearing all Black and refusing to come out to the jury box upon arrival. The media described this incident as a jury revolt, and the protesters wearing all Black resembling a funeral procession. Prosecution case. Deputy District Attorneys Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden were the 2 lead prosecutors. Clark was designated as a lead prosecutor, and Darden became Clark's co-counsel. Prosecutors Hank Goldberg and William Hodgman, who had successfully prosecuted high-profile cases in the past, assisted Clark and Darden. 2 prosecutors who were DNA experts, Rocknan Harmon and George Woody Clark, were brought in to present the DNA evidence in the case and were asserted by prosecutor Lisa Kahn. The theory. So the prosecution argued that the domestic violence against the domestic violence within the Simpson-Brown marriage culminated in her murder. Simpson's history of abusing Brown resulted in their divorce and him pleading guilty to 1 count of domestic violence in 1989. On the night of the murder, Simpson attended a dance recital for his daughter and was reportedly angry with Brown because of a Black dress that she wore, which he said was tight. Simpson's then-girlfriend Paula Barb Erie wanted to attend the recital with Simpson, but he did not invite her. After the recital, Simpson returned home to a voicemail from Barb Erie, ending their relationship. Oh, okay. According to the prosecution, Simpson then drove to Brown's home in his Ford Bronco to reconnect their relationship as a result, and when Brown refused, Simpson killed her in a, quote, final act of control, end quote. Goldman then came upon the scene to return some eyeglasses and was murdered to silence him and remove any witnesses. Afterward, the prosecution said that Simpson walked to his Bronco and drove home, where he parked it and walked into his house. There, he took off his bloodstained clothes, put them in the knapsack, except his socks are in the glove, put clean ones on, and left towards the limousine. At the airport, the prosecution said that Simpson opened the knapsack, removed the clothes, Bruno Mangiali's shoes, and the murder weapon, and threw them in the trash before putting the knapsack in one of his suitcases and headed towards his flight. Now the domestic violence. So the prosecution opened its case by calling LAPD 911 dispatcher Sharon Gilbert and playing a 4-minute 911 call from Brown on January 1st, 1989, literally on New Year's Day, oh my God, in which she expressed fear that Simpson would physically harm her, and Simpson himself is even heard in the background yelling at her and possibly hitting her as well. The officer who responded to that call, Detective John Edwards, testified next that when he arrived, a severely beaten Brown ran from the bushes where she was hiding and to the detective screaming, quote, "He's going to kill me, he's going to kill me," end quote, referring to Simpson. Pictures of Brown's face from that night were then shown to the jury to confirm his testimony. That incident led to Simpson's arrest and eventual pleading of no contest to 1 count of domestic violence, for which he received probation for 1 year. LAPD officer and longtime friend of both Simpson and Brown, Ron Shipp, testified on February 1st, 1995, that Simpson told him the day after the murders that he did not want to take a polygraph test offered to him by the police because he said, quote, "I've had a lot of dreams about killing her. I don't know about taking that thing," end quote. Oh my God. The jury dismissed Shipp's claims after defense attorney Carl E. Douglas accused him of being an alcoholic who testified against Simpson because he wanted to promote his acting career, obviously. The prosecution then called Brown's sister to the witness stand. She testified to many domestic violence episodes in the 1980s, where she saw Simpson pick up his wife and hurl her against a wall, then physically throw her out of their house during an argument. She also testified that Simpson was agitated with Brown at the night of their daughter's dance recital, the same night Brown was murdered. Although a home videotape was taken immediately after the dance recital showed a cheerful Simpson being given a kiss by Brown's sister, Cato Kalin, corroborated Brown's sister's claim that Simpson was upset with Brown because of the black dress she wore, which he said was tights. Yeah, I know that back at the Bronco chase that Simpson had talked with his coach or something. Let me see again one more time. Bronco, yes, phone call, something like that. I'm trying to see. Unfortunately, I cannot find them. So sorry, guys. I'm sorry. That's damn it. Oh well. So the prosecution planned to present 62 separate incidents of domestic violence, including three previously unknown incidents Brown had documented in several letters she had written and placed in a bank safety deposit box. Judge Ito denied the defense motion to suppress domestic violence incidents, but only allow witness accounts to be presented to the jury because of Simpson's, of course, Sixth Amendment rights. The letters Brown had written and the statements she made to friends and family were ruled inadmissible as hearsay because Brown was dead and unable to be cross-examined. Despite this, the prosecution had witnesses for 44 separate incidents they planned to present to the jury. However, the prosecution dropped the domestic violence portion of their case on June 20, 1995. Marsha Clark stated it was because they believed that the DNA evidence against Simpson was insurmountable. Still, the media speculated it was because of the comments by dismissed Jeanette Harris. Christopher Darden later confirmed that to be true. Harris was dismissed on April 6 because she failed to disclose that she was a victim of domestic violence from her ex-husband. But afterward, Harris gave an interview and called evidence of Simpson's abuse of Brown, quote, "a whole lot of nothing," end quote, and said again, quote, "that doesn't mean he is guilty of murder," end quote. The dismissal of Simpson's abusive behavior from a female juror who was also a victim of such abuse by her husband convinced the prosecution that the jury was not receptive to the domestic violence argument. After the verdict, the jurors called the domestic violence portion of the case a, quote, "waste of time," end quote. Shapiro, Dershowitz, and Yulman later admitted they believed that race played a factor in the jury's dismissal of Brown's abuse by Simpson. So the defense retained a renowned advocate for victims of domestic abuse. Dr. Lenore E. Walker Cochran said that she will testify that Simpson does not fit the profile of an abuser that would murder his spouse. Walker's colleagues were appalled by her decision to defend Simpson and accused her of betraying her advocacy for a $250,000 retainer. Wait, what? Welker was dropped from the witness list for technical reasons after submitting her case reports. In it, she opines that the statistic from Dershowitz that of the 2 million incidents of abuse per year, only 2,000 victims are murdered by their spouses as being misleading because Brown was already dead. The relevant statistic was, quote, of the murdered spouses who were also victims of abuse, what percentage of them were murdered by their current or ex-husband, end quote. When she reported that the number was 80.3%, they dropped her from the witness list. The revelation of Simpson's abuse of Brown is credited with turning public opinion against him. The public shock at why Welker was dropped from the defense witness list is credited with transforming public opinion on spousal abuse from a private familial matter to a severe public health issue. Timeline: Los Angeles County Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Lakshmanan Sathyavagiswanan testified on June 14, 1995, that Brown's time of death was estimated as between 10 o'clock p.m. and 10:30 p.m. Kalin testified on March 22, 1995, that he last saw Simpson at 9:36 p.m. that evening. Simpson was not seen again until 10:54 p.m. when he answered the intercom at the front door for the limousine driver, Ellen Park. Simpson had no alibi for approximately 1 hour and 18 minutes, during which time the murders took place. Park testified on March 28 that he arrived at Simpson's home at 10:25 p.m. on the night of the murders and stopped at the Rockingham entrance. Simpson's Bronco was not there. He then drove to the Ashford entrance and rang the intercom 3 times, getting no answer, starting at 10:40 p.m. At approximately 10:50 p.m., he saw a, quote, tall African-American shadowy figures resembling Simpson, end quote, approach the front door before aborting towards the southern walkway that leads to Kalin's bungalow. Park's testimony was significant because it explained the location of the glove found at Simpson's home. The blood trail from the Bronco to the front door was easily understood, but the glove was found on the other side of the house. Park said the shadowy figure initially approached the front door before heading down the southern walkway where Fur Herman found the glove. The prosecution believed that Simpson had driven his Bronco to and from Brown's home to commit the murders, so that Park was there and aborted his attempt to enter through the front door and tried to enter through the back instead. He panicked and made the sounds that Kalin heard when he realized that the security system would not let him enter through the rear entrance. He discarded the glove, returned, and went through the front door. During cross-examination, Park conceded that he could not identify the figure, but said he saw that person enter the front door. And at the word, Simpson answered and said he was home alone. Park conceded that he did not notice any cuts on Simpson's left hand, but added, quote, I shook his right hand, not his left, end quote. I'm going to do the next part, part 4. I'll be right back.